We live in a world that we are doing a lot of reading on screens. The way that we read has changed over the last several years, both in how deep we read and our attention span. And there have been plenty of studies to show how this is deteriorating at different times and in different ways. But the reality is, what we're lacking many times is depth in our reading, because we're not asked to read very deeply. I feel like I'm a bit loud. Am I a bit loud today, or is it just me? Can we bring me down just a little bit? It might be just me this morning. If it is, ignore me if it is. So our depth of reading has been challenged, because a lot of times what we're reading is not intended to be deep. We're intended to get 6 points for something, or 7 ways to do something, or at the bottom of the article, we're pointed to another place where we could read deeper, which we really don't want to do, because we just want the summation of it. And I don't know if you're like me, but I'm tempted sometimes to think, okay, I got that, move on. And if it doesn't capture our attention just the first couple of seconds, we swipe, right? And we get rid of it, and we go to something else. Well, there's some researchers at RMIT University in Melbourne, the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology University, and they have been working on fonts that would help us to read deeper. And they have used scientific studies, and they've come up with all kinds of different fonts that they put in front of people, and they have now come up with a font that is by design, it reaches the desirable difficulty, is what they call it. The desirable difficulty that makes it just hard enough for us to read, to dig deeper and read deeper, but not so hard that we swipe to the next one. And they call this font, I love this name, Sans Forgetica. Without forgetting is what they call the font, Sans Forgetica. And the whole intent is to make you read deeper, to make you read more focused, because part of every letter is missing. You can look it up and you can see it online. Part of every letter is missing. And you've seen these little memes and posts that come through where it challenges you to read when letters are missing or vowels are missing or certain shades of color take over. Well, this font is a scientific effort to get us to read deeper so that we do not forget. So that we do not forget what we're reading, and what we're reading takes hold. But for us, as we think of theological things, there are certain things we're tempted to forget because we're not experiencing it in the same way. So we have to remind ourselves sometime to not only not to forget, but we have to remember. We have to remember, we're not just forgetting what we're reading, but we're also remember what we're reading. And sometimes what we're reading is so foreign to us that we're not experiencing it in the same way. Well, when we come to the idea of the judgment and the second coming of Christ, for many of us, that's the same way. Now, in our world, when we think about the judgment of Christ, the second coming of Christ and the judgment that happens, the world can't stand that. That is an unloving God to come and judge. And what right does he have to do that? And millions of other arguments against that. For us as believers, especially in the United States in the 21st century, sometimes for us it's like, yeah, we know he's coming, but we don't experientially feel it. We're not living in those places where if there isn't a hope of judgment, then what hope do we have? Because evil is so rampant. I read this week of a pastor who knew a man in Mozambique and, no, not Mozambique, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I had two illustrations and I wanted to know which one to use, and I started out on the wrong one. He knew a man who lived in a regime of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where he saw all kinds of atrocities. And his family got pushed out of that country, and they went to Uganda, and they were refugees, and they didn't have any money. They had enough money to buy food, one meal for their family every other day, and they lived in shanties, and this man became a pastor. And I read about a pastor's interaction with him, an American pastor who interacted with this man whose name is Emma. And in recounting the hopelessness that could overtake them during those days, he said this: "You know, Mark, I could never believe the gospel if it were not for the judgment of God, because I will never get injustice in this world. You won't understand it. But I could cope with it. I could not cope with it if I was never going to see justice done. If I have to deal with justice, I could never cope with it if I didn't think there was a hope that justice would be done." And see, the problem is that a lot of times we as human beings decide we know what justice needs to be done, when it needs to be done, and how it needs to be done. And we violate those clear passages that say we leave the vengeance to the Lord, because that's not our role. So we not only don't want to forget about the second coming of Christ and the judgment that comes there, but we want to remember that all the time, because it's going to motivate us, especially as we walk into times of suffering in our lifetime that may not have been what we've experienced in the past. When persecution comes, remembering that there is a righteous judge who is coming in justice to judge justly motivates us in a joyful way. But if that's the case, we should not only not forget and we should remember, but we should also warn, right? We should also warn people. I read of another pastor and evangelist, Rico Tice, who talked about visiting a friend in Australia. And while he was visiting this friend, they went down to this particular beach and he was going to go for a swim. Well, all around this beach were signs to say, don't swim, warning, sharks. And he said, I really didn't see them. But my friend said, you don't want to go take that. You don't want to go swim. He goes, but yes, I do. I want to go swim. He says, no, do you see those signs? They're there for a reason. Ah, don't worry about that. I'll be okay with that. And the man turned to him who he was with. And he said, listen, mate, 200 Australians have died in shark attacks. You've got to decide whether those shark signs are there to save you or to ruin you, to ruin your fun. You're of age, you decide. Well, that's us. With this knowledge that there is a coming judgment, we are going to warn people. They're of age. Romans 1 tells us that they see the evidence of God in the world around them. They may not realize that that judgment is coming, and they may not see it with clarity, and part of our job is to lovingly warn them about this judgment. Now, we can be fire and brimstone preachers, and sometimes that's required. Some of you may have thought that's what the sermon was last week, was fire and brimstone, because it was kind of fiery and brimstone-y in that section of Scripture. But if we're not burdened for the souls of the people that we're telling that to, then we're missing the point of the gospel. And you say, what does that have to do with our text today? That's all preparation to receive what we're seeing in our text today. What we see in our text today, we have had alluded to. We have had even described in detail what will happen when the day comes, but we haven't seen in the visions of Revelation it actually coming and happening. And that's what we see today in our text in Revelation 14. So for us, the themes that are here, we've already interacted with. The truths that are here, we've already interacted with. The way God is going to work, we've already interacted with. But in the visions of Revelation, we are seeing it happen. We're seeing it come to us. John is seeing the actual harvesting brought in these agricultural metaphors of harvest, the second coming of Christ and the judgment of non-believers and the reaping for grace and glory of the believers. So we'll set that all up in just a moment, but turn, if you will, to Revelation chapter 14. And let's stand together as I read these verses, 14 through 20. Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man, with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe. So he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. Then another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, the angel who has authority over the fire, and he called with a loud voice to the one who had the sharp sickle, put in your sickle and gather the clusters from the vines of the earth, for its grapes are ripe. So the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered the grape harvest and the earth of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia. The grass withers, and the flower fades. You may be seated. So my outline this week is simple. It is the twofold explanation of the harvest as brought to us in the vision in chapter 14. We're shown a vision of the two harvests of the final judgment. Two harvests of the final judgment. Now, there's some questions we need to answer right off the bat that I hope to do so quickly because it can derail what we're seeing in the text. We might not agree upon everything that is in this text on how to interpret it, but we will agree in the main point. Jesus is returning, and those who are not in Christ will suffer eternally. We've just had that brought to us in great description in chapter 14, 6 through 11, and then a reminder of where we are as saints in the midst of that. So in true fashion of Revelation, we have two pictures. Now, we could go either way. We could say that, you know, the questions that we need to answer. Who is the one that's riding on the clouds? And is this two groups of people harvested or one group of people harvested and described in two different ways? Those are things we need to answer. My outline tips off part of that I think these are two groups of people. Now, let me tell you, there are strong arguments on both sides of this, of whether the verses 14 through 16 are speaking of the judgment of the wicked, and verses 17 through 20 are speaking of the judgment of the wicked in more detail. That would fit in one sense the way Revelation is brought to us often, wouldn't it? Where we have a statement, and then a little while later we'll see a statement that's covering the same time period but in greater depth. And then a little while later we'll see the same thing again in greater depth. So it's not far off for that. The second question of who this one who is on the white cloud, who is the cloud rider, that impacts what we're talking about here. So I'm going to say that the one riding on the white cloud is Jesus himself. As we go through verse 14, I'll show you why I think that. You may think this is not Jesus for very valid reasons, but I think this is Jesus himself, and he's gathering in the harvest of the elect. He's gathering in the grain harvest of the elect. And so if we just set those out there before us, and let's just take a look at this text for a moment. The harvest of the righteous includes all of Christ's people, the first fruits, those he has sealed, and leads to God's blessing and eternal reward. Let me read that again, because you're going to look back at your text and you're going to say, where do you get all that? The harvest of the righteous includes all of Christ's people, the first fruits, those he has sealed, and leads to God's blessing and eternal reward. Well, let's cover the second part of that first. Have we seen over and over and over the blessing that God's people get when Jesus returns? So we're taking all of that assumption, those promises in the seven churches, the promises of a church that's victorious on the earth and also standing victorious in heaven, all those people who are elect from the foundation of the world, we have seen their eternal state, worshiping the Lamb, free of sin, completely there because of the blood of the Lamb, but their works have followed them because they have given evidence that they were saved in this life. So if that is what happens when Jesus returns, we can safely say that even though this text doesn't recount it for us, this is what happens to believers when Jesus returns and sets up his new kingdom. Or he consummates his kingdom, not sets up his new kingdom, consummates his kingdom in the new Jerusalem and the new heavens and new earth. Also, we learned last week that believers were the first fruits. Now we learned that first fruits can be literally those the first fruits out of the field, the one that's harvested first. But we also learned that the first fruits are those that are set aside for God's glory. And that was the emphasis that we saw in chapter 14 in those first five verses, that they were the God's people are set aside for his glory. They are the first fruits in the sense they are his. He has taken them and he has set them aside for his work. So remembering that believers are the first fruits helps us see the fulfillment in the grain metaphor that we have here. So, verse 14. Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man, with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. So we have this sickle that appears. Sickle appears seven times in these verses. Isn't it amazing how many times John records this vision with numbers of 7 and 10 and 12 and numbers that lead us to an understanding. So there are seven sickles The sickle is mentioned seven times in these verses. So it's a sharp sickle that's in his hand. Now, what is a sickle used for? It's used for taking out weeds. It's used for harvesting grain. It's a sharp sword. It's a sharp sword on the end of a stick that is used for certain purposes in agricultural metaphors. And that's what we have here, don't we? We have agricultural metaphors that these folks in the first century would have understood more than many of us do today. Many of us are city folk. We're not country folk. We're not understanding harvest and grain and all of that. But they would have understood it completely. And so these metaphors, remember, in Revelation, we have these pictures that are real, right? John is really seeing these pictures, right? We're not just saying that these are just things John's writing down. John is seeing these things in his vision. But they are representative of earthly and heavenly realities. And so that's what we have here. And look what we have first. Someone on a white cloud, seated on that cloud, one like a son of man, with a golden crown on his head. Now, if we just had that verse, who would you say this person is? Jesus, right? We would have to say that because we've already seen in Daniel chapter 7, we've returned to these verses many times in Daniel chapter 7, 13 and 14, where one like the Son of Man approaches the Ancient of Days who's seated on his throne and all authority is given to the one like the Son of Man. And we've put that in its context when we preached through Daniel together and we looked at it. We put it in its context several times in Revelation already. So we're expecting to see, especially when we see that language, one like a son of man, if you see a cloud rider, you're seeing God. Only God rides on the clouds. So when we see this, this is what we're automatically thinking. We're thinking that this is Jesus himself. This is the way we were introduced to Jesus in this first chapter with language like this. We also see that he is one like a son of man. That was Jesus' favorite word and phrase for himself. It freed himself from all of the apocalyptic fervor that was of the day. That was his favorite word for himself, and he took it right out of Daniel chapter 7. We also see that he has a golden crown on his head. Now, this crown is the crown of a victor. It fits our setting here. Jesus is coming to reap because he is the one who is victorious. He is the one who has already preserved all of his people. He is the one who has already done the work to make sure that his people are protected in the next age. And so we're seeing in verse 14, this one like a son of man. Now, there's some people that would say, and I think with strong argument, to things we have to answer. In the very next verse, we see another angel that calls out to this one like a son of man and seemingly gives him his marching orders, seemingly gives the call for him to work. And why would Jesus need an angel to tell him what to do? Well, first of all, we know that whoever is riding on the clouds is being told by the angel that the time is now. The time for the harvesting is now. And so I understand the tension here to say, why would Jesus need an angel to tell him? But if we think about the economy of Revelation and what we've been learning about in Revelation, this revelation is given to John to give to the seven churches, right, in order to encourage them. So John needs to know what's going on. Now, some people would say, as you move on into verse 15, another angel came out of the temple calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud. So he's coming from the temple. So he's coming from whose presence? God's presence in Revelation, right? The angel is coming from God's presence and he calls out to the one who sat on the cloud. So the one thing we say is whatever he has to say is coming from God himself. Now that's been constant for us in Revelation, right? To remember that all of the judgments that we see throughout history are coming from the throne. God is in charge of them. He's the one who is the one who executes vengeance in the way he sees fit at his time. And the end will come and all wrongs will be put right. Everything will be restored at that point. But all of this comes from the throne. We don't have to worry as believers that what we're looking at around us is evil gone rampant without God's knowledge or control of it. God is always in control. So this fits our pattern that this word would come from the throne of God. So why is it that an angel would have to tell Jesus it's time? Well, some people would point to the passage in Mark that says that in Jesus' humanity, he didn't know the time of the end times. He didn't know when the Lord would be coming back. The angels didn't know. Not even the Son of Man knew. Well, in Jesus' humanity, I think that's a true statement, right? The scriptures tell us that. In his humanity, he did not know that. But he's exalted now. Does he still not know it? I don't really want to go there. I don't really want to go and say Jesus doesn't have that knowledge now. He is exalted in his incarnate form. So there could be a side of him that doesn't know it, but his God side knows it. The part of him who is God knows this timing. But I want you to see in the text, nowhere does it say that the one riding on the clouds doesn't know its time. It doesn't say that. For John's benefit, John has to know, wow, this is time. So somebody has to make the announcement that this is time. And we would expect that to come from the throne. So I can easily see Jesus in this vision, sitting on the clouds, preparing to do his work, knowing the time is there, and waiting for the angel to give God's command. Waiting for the angel to give God's command so that everyone knows what is about to happen. And everybody knows that what we're watching is of utmost importance. Turn to Matthew, if you will. Let's look at a couple of passages. Turn to Matthew 13 first. Jesus put another parable before them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while his men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared also. And the servants of the master of the house came and said to him, 'Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have weeds?' He said to them, 'An enemy has done this.' So the servant said to him, 'Then do you want us to go and gather them?' But he said, 'No, lest in gathering the weeds you root up the wheat along with them. Let both grow together until the harvest, and at the harvest time I will tell the reapers, gather the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" Now skip down to verse 36, where he explains this parable. "Then he left the crowds and went into the house, and his disciples came to him, saying, 'Explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field.' He answered, 'The one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed is the sons of the kingdom. The weeds are the sons of the evil one. And the enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the close of the age, and the reapers are angels. Just as the weeds are gathered and burned with fire, so will it be at the close of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all lawbreakers, and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear.'" Now you can see in here is another strong argument for someone who would say that in Revelation 14 and 15, that in 14, that the one like a son of man is actually an angel. Because it says right here, the angels would do this. Now remember, parables are given to us that we might know truth, but not every aspect of every parable needs to be pressed. Because we are seeing in Revelation 14, the close of the age and the judgment described in a different way, but with the same outcome, the righteous being gathered, the unrighteous being gathered for different purposes, for different ends, but we're seeing it described differently in the Gospels. So we have this same picture brought to us using different metaphors that have different little tweaks to them that if we press them all together, we're going to say, well, they contradict each other and they can't be true, therefore it's all false. And that's not where we start with biblical interpretation, is it? We understand that in these parables, there is one, sometimes two major truths, and all of those little details aren't to be pressed into completion to find out, okay, well, it has to happen exactly that way, and this means that, and this means that. We have a lot of direction of what each of those parts of the parable mean, but we also have the same picture being given to us in chapter 14, verses 14 through 20, this judgment on the end of the at the end of the age. Turn now to Matthew chapter 24. Verse 29. "You Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Some people would find this to be referring to the first century and the fall of Jerusalem. I think this particular section of Matthew 24 refers to the second coming of Christ. Remember that in the Olivet Discourse, we jump back and forth between the second coming of Christ, or between the description of the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 and the second coming of Christ. This is one of the passages that deal with the second coming. And we see it clearly. Believers have a specific place in this time of judgment. We see it brought to us in different ways using different metaphors, but believers are protected from the wrath of God as it is brought out in the final judgment. Turn back, if you will, to Revelation 14. Look in verse 15. And another angel came out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, "Put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe." Now, this word for harvest here refers to a grain harvest. So it matches the metaphors that we just read about in Matthew that Jesus gave about this time of his return in judgment. So this command, this order from God to put all of this in motion, to put your sickle in and reap, for the hour to reap has come. Why has the hour to reap come? Because the harvest is ripe. The harvest of the earth is fully ripe. Remember when Jesus says in different occasions, like in John chapter 4, he says the fields are white with harvest. It's just the laborers who are few. There's a field to be harvested. The gospel should be preached. There are more people that God has to bring unto himself so that the harvest is complete and it's full and it's ripe and it's ready to be reaped. It's ready to be brought in. Because when all the elect reach their point of salvation, when God has redeemed them, the end will come. And so what we're seeing is that point where the grain harvest in these particular verses, 14, 15, and 16, the grain harvest representing the believers, using that imagery from Matthew, representing the believers, that this is something that Jesus, in Revelation, Jesus has brought as the one doing it. Remember, this is to comfort suffering believers in the first century and today. What greater comfort than to see that Jesus is the one who is doing this? Jesus may choose to send his angels out to do that. Other passages say the exact same thing. Here, it says that Jesus is involved in it for us, for our comfort. We know, as the tenor of Revelation has shown us, everything is in control of God. Nothing is outside of his control. No one will be lost that should be saved. No one will be saved that should be lost. No one will be rewarded for their deeds in a way that makes us puzzled if we understand what God means by those works and by those deeds and how they're tied to Christ. Because they are the first fruits, as already mentioned earlier in chapter 14, the ones set apart by God. Verse 16. So he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. Now we can put in there the rest of the teaching of Revelation, and as the earth was reaped, they meet their eternal reward. Because that's what we've learned. The promise to the seven churches, the promise of the church victorious, the promise of the work of Christ bringing everyone that Christ intends into their eternal rest. Not eternal unrest, as we learned earlier in chapter 14, but eternal rest. So this is the reaping that happens for believers. We've been studying this all of Revelation, and it's summarized here in three verses. But look at the other part of the second coming of Christ in the day of judgment. God's harvest of the wicked includes all of Christ's enemies, those sealed by the mark of the beast, and leads to God's wrath and eternal punishment. Now, we've already met them several times, most recently just last week in chapter 14, verses 6 through 11. We meet those who have been taking the mark of the beast, that are falling under his spell, that are worshiping the idol, that are doing the things in opposite of what God's people do. We've learned that they are going to be judged, and we've learned what their torment is going to be like eternally with no rest. The believers have rest. The unbelievers do not have rest. We already know what that looks like. This is the actual action of it happening. Look in verse 17. Then another angel came out of the temple in heaven. So again, coming out with God's marching orders, coming out from his presence. And he too had a sharp sickle. So we know that we're in the same time frame of harvest. And another angel came out from the altar, the angel who has authority over the fire. Now we need to stop right there. That tells us something, doesn't it? This is the angel who has authority over the fire. We met in chapter 8, right? The angel has authority over the fire, has authority over judgment. God's authority exercised through the angel, but he's the one who approaches the altar and takes some of the fire and throws it to the earth. So this is the same angel who's in charge of judgment, now being involved in this final judgment. The angel has authority over the fire, and he called with a loud voice to the one who had the sharp sickle. So another announcement, this is what's going on. This is from the Father, because this is coming from the altar. Put in your sickle and gather the clusters from the vine, or more literally, gather the vines of the earth, for its grapes are ripe. So another picture, we move from grain to grapes, right? We move from grain into fruit, into the grapes. And it's ripe as well. And since we know we're in the presence of the wrath of God at this point, clearly coming up, we know that this is the unbelievers, those who have been sealed, those who have taken the mark of the beast and shown their allegiance to the beast and the dragon rather than to God. And there, this is how their end is described. So put in your sickle, gather the clusters from the vine. I think it's better to say gather the vines of the earth, for its grapes are ripe. So the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered the grape harvest of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. The great winepress of the wrath of God. So we have this picture of the winepress. When the grapes were harvested, they were brought in. They were put in a vat that had a trough underneath it. And people would get in with their feet and they would squash the grapes. And that those grapes, the juice would be freed from the grape, and the skins would be left in the top part, and the bottom part would include the grape juice running down the trough into its destination. Now, we in America are tempted to see the Lucy show in this, right? Have you ever seen that, where they're stomping grapes? We're tempted to see that and the comedic fare that it is. It's not that. It shouldn't cloud our memory. It shouldn't cloud our remembrance or our knowledge. Now, this little phrase here, the grapes, the winepress of the wrath of God, and if we just keep reading to the end, and the winepress was trodden outside the city, and the blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia. So this picture is of God's wrath being meted out. Now, In American history, this grapes of wrath kind of picture has a kind of a tainted picture for us. You know the grapes of wrath of John Steinbeck, his novel, where he is saying that it's unrighteous for the oppression of those farmers in California, right? So he uses that imagery that the people who are doing the oppression need to experience this kind of wrath. And so in the novel, we are to feel sorry for one group and expect the punishment the punishment of another group. Do you know where the title from that book came from? It came from a hymn. It's a hymn that's in a lot of hymnals, and it surprises me that it's in a lot of hymnals. Battle Hymn of the Republic. A hymn written by a woman who wrote of the righteous pursuit of the North against the South. That's her purpose in writing the hymn. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps. I can read his righteous sentence by the dim and flaring lamps. His day is marching on. I have read a fiery gospel, written burnished rows of steel. As ye deal with my contemners, so with you my grace shall deal. Let the hero, capital H, born of woman, crush the serpent with his heel, since God is marching on. He has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on. In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free while God is marching on. Now, you've probably read that, let us live to make men free. But she originally wrote, as Christ died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. Now, this is great theology of the return of Christ, isn't it? It's poor application in that theology to think this is what needs to happen now. No judgment on whether slavery is good or bad. No judgment on North or South. Just reminding us that it is a songwriter who's applying these truths to a specific situation in a way that meets human understanding of what's going on. We're rather bold at times to, and that wasn't the first time that The Grapes of Wrath was the title of a novel. In 1901, written before this, published in 1901, but written before this song, there was a book written that was about the North and the South, and it was called The Grapes of Wrath. So we look at this and we say, okay, I get it. I understand God is going to punish sin, and therefore there's sin in the world that needs to be punished. But just because the theology of the song is good about Jesus, it may not be the best song for us to sing. Because it is not us who decides who is trampled in this judgment. It is not us to decide who will be harvested in that harvest of the vines and the grapes that are ready. Each of those that I just mentioned are a metaphor used by humans to exact the justice that they see fit in a limited way, but this metaphor comes from this text. So let's look at it just a little bit closer. This is another angel that comes ready, equipped with the sickle. And in all of this, we are to keep in mind Old Testament pictures. And this is another argument that I think people might have in order to say both of these are dealing with the same judgment, even though it doesn't convince me. Turn to Joel chapter 3. Joel chapter 3. Hosea, Joel. Look at verse 11. Hasten and come, all you surrounding nations, and gather yourselves there. Bring down your warriors, O Lord. Let the nations stir themselves up and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Go in, tread, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their evil is great. Now, do you see both metaphors of grain and wine being used in Joel chapter 3 to talk about one aspect of the final judgment? I think that weighs for people who would like to say that these are both the same in Revelation 14. But I want you to turn to another chapter as well, Isaiah 63. Isaiah 63. And this will be the last one I think I have you turn to. Look at the first verse. Who is this who comes from Edom in crimsoned garments from Bozrah? He who is splendid in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. It is I speaking in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your apparel red and your garments like his who treads in the winepress? I have trodden the winepress alone, and from the peoples no one was with me. I trod them in my anger. I trampled them in my wrath. Their lifeblood splattered on my garments and stained all my apparel. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption has come. See, this language coming from the Old Testament is God himself coming to deal with the people who ignore his pleas to turn to him. Deal with the people who remain in their unrighteousness. Now, when we see this metaphor come again in Revelation chapter 19, we're going to see that it's actually Jesus who is doing the treading of the winepress. It is Jesus himself who is doing this. We never, no matter how much we try to understand what's going on in verses 14 through 20, we do not want to remove the fact that all judgment is from the Lord. It is the holy and righteous one seated on his throne in Daniel who gives the ability to judge to the one like the Son of Man who comes to him. And we see that working itself out throughout history in the life and death of Jesus, but also in his second coming when he comes again to judge the wicked and the dead, as the confessions say. So look back in Revelation 14. It's time to gather those who are enemies of God and this picture of God's wrath, reminding us of what we've already learned in chapter 14, the wine of the passion of Babylon and the wine of God's wrath poured full strength into the cup of his anger. We see that same imagery being used here. Verse 19, so the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered the grape harvest of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden, like I said in chapter 19, we'll learn Jesus is trodding it, outside the city. I think that's the holy city, Jerusalem, outside. Remember, we've alluded to this when we get to the chapters that talk about the new Jerusalem, the new heaven and new earth and a new Jerusalem. All the righteousness is outside of the city. There is no all the unrighteousness is outside of the city. There's no unrighteousness in the city. It's only righteousness. So this picture gives us the picture of outside the city. And blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle, so shoulder to head high, and 1,600 stadia. That's about 184 miles. So are we to go out and measure and say, okay, blood's going to go this high from here to there? We're not, are we? We're to say this is complete. This is complete. 40 times 40, 4 times 10 times 100. This is what we're trying to get to. This 4 times 4 times 100. This is what we're getting to, is the perfection of God's work. There will be no one left out. See, on this day, we've been shown over and over in Revelation, there are two groups, those who are for him and those who are against him, those who love him, those who hate him, those who are sealed by him, those who are sealed by Satan, by the dragon and the beast, those who worship God, those who worship Satan. There's only two, and this is the end result of both of those. Now, there have been times throughout our history where people have taken this and preached it to the churches as everybody in the church was lost, and how wise that would be to remind us of the severity of the judgment of God. You've heard many times of the sermon of Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. You've heard that. You've probably heard passages talking about it where they quote Jonathan Edwards saying that the lost man is dangling like a in a spider's web and it's only God who holds him. And it's very vivid imagery. And when he preached that sermon, there were people on their faces on the ground crying out, "How shall we be saved?" They were underneath their own suffering of their own sin. Do you know what's amazing about that sermon? Two things I want to draw your attention that I think are amazing. He preached that sermon at another church, and it was basically just, "Oh, nice sermon, preacher." There wasn't that much response to it at all. It was just a good sermon. But he preaches it at Enfield under the unction of the Holy Spirit to a group of people who needed to hear this way of giving the final judgment, and they're crushed by it. And this style of sermon wasn't usually preached to a church. It was usually preached in prison. This was the typical style of sermon to preach in a prison. Those people who may be facing death at any time, to remind them that if they don't repent of their wicked ways, this is the ending. This is their ending. And he preached that to a group of believers as if they were lost, and God revealed that there were people who were lost among them. And this was right in the middle of the Great Awakening. And he challenged everything about their own standing in their own strength. I want you to listen just to one passage. This is his ninth point of doctrine. He has many. This is his ninth. All wicked men's pains and contrivance they use to escape hell while they continue to reject Christ and so remain wicked men, don't secure them from hell for a moment. Almost every natural man that hears of hell flatters himself that he shall escape it. He depends upon himself for his own security. He flatters himself in what he has done and what he is now doing or what he intends to do. Everyone lays out matters in his own mind how he shall avoid damnation and flatters himself that he contrives well for himself and that his schemes won't fail. They hear indeed that there are but few saved, and that the bigger part of men that have died heretofore are gone to hell, but each one imagines that he lays out matters better for his own escape than others have done. He don't intend to come, that's the language, he don't intend to come to that place of torment. He says within himself that he intends to take care that shall be effectual and to order matters so for himself as not to fail. But the foolish children of men do miserably delude themselves in their own schemes and in their own contrivances, in their own strength and wisdom. They trust to nothing but a shadow. The bigger part of those that heretofore have lived under the same means of grace and are now dead are undoubtedly gone to hell. And it was not because they were not as wise as those who are now alive. It was not because they do not lay out matters as well for themselves to secure their own escape. If it were so, that we could come to speak with them and could inquire of them one by one whether they expected when alive and when they used to hear about hell ever to be the subjects of that misery, we doubtless should hear one and another reply, "No, I never intended to come here. I laid out matters otherwise in my mind. I thought I should contrive as well for myself. I thought my scheme good. I intended to take effectual care, but it came upon me unexpected. I did not look for it at that time and in that manner. It came as a thief. Death outwitted me. God's wrath was too quick for me. Oh, my cursed foolishness. I was flattering myself and pleasing myself with vain dreams of what I would do hereafter. And when I was saying peace and safety, then suddenly destruction came upon me." Now, if you are one who is holding on to your own strength and your own security, thinking that you have it down better than someone else, Jonathan Edwards tears that to pieces for us by summoning up those who were already in hell to come back and bear witness that it was nothing like they thought. This is what happens in the grapes of wrath. This is what happens when God's wrath comes. There will be no escape at that day. Now, our job, I told you at the beginning, part of our job is warning. We need to remember, we need to understand, right, and not forget, but part of our job is also warning other people. Now, we can go about our business standing on a street corner, and there's nothing wrong with that. Don't think I'm taking a jab at this. Standing on a street corner and preaching fire and brimstone, or taking all of Jonathan Edwards' sermon, which this is an easy part. This is a mild part. There's another part that I have that I was going to read that we don't have time for that calls all creation to bear on the sinner. Thinking air, saying things like, "You think you're breathing because you've done things right. The air doesn't even want to have you breathe. The land doesn't want to hold you. The earth doesn't want to hold you up." Talking about all creation pushing against the sinfulness of you, the lost person who thinks they can stand in God's presence and stand on their own righteousness. Those are all true statements. But if your heart doesn't break for the people you preach to, if your heart isn't breaking for them as you preach, then you're missing the essence of the gospel that is given in love. It's given in love. So when we are witnessing to other people about these horrid truths, if they're heading in that direction, our hearts should be breaking. They should see our tears over them, that we're broken over them, and that we would do anything that we could to respond or to give them this truth in a way that would cause them to respond, knowing that God is the one who gives that grace. So our hearts need to be broken. We are not only not forgetting this truth, because this is what drives us, doesn't it? The more you reach into the world and the more evil affects you, don't you understand more the need for righteous judgment? Don't you understand more the pleasing nature of righteous judgment, that there will come a day where that evil that seems to have no gate, no stop, no harness whatsoever, that it will meet its match in the righteous and holy judgment of God himself? And if we're not resting there, I can tell you your end is futile, because you cannot exact the judgment that God can exact. And every time somebody is the actor in one of those evil circumstances, you do not know whether God has yet to save them. So if it's up to you to exact judgment and you say, that's evil, that's clearly evil, and I intend to judge that evil now, you do not know that in the next breath, God may save them and redeem them. And what right do you have to judge that which God intends to redeem? This is how we live our life. This is how it encourages us not to shrink back. Evil does not overtake us because we are the ones who overcome. Now, what I want you to do when you go home today, I want you to go back to chapters 2 and 3, and I want you to read those letters to the seven churches and pay particular attention to those prizes that we have before us, to those rewards that are waiting on us, to those descriptions of our presence with Jesus Christ, those descriptions of the bliss that we have, not dealing with sin any longer, but being in the midst of Christ and being in the midst of God and the Lamb and worshiping in Him forever. That is what we lean for. And we want others to come with us. So we preach the truth of a gospel that has God coming back to judge the wicked, but we also preach the truth of the gospel that Jesus Christ redeems men today. Jesus Christ redeems those who will be in the first part of this harvest, who will be harvested under Him Himself as the first fruit, set apart for His glory, and will worship Him forever in rest. That motivates us for our evangelism, and it motivates us for our holiness. I read this week of a story. I'm not going to dig up the details, but it was a pastor in New York City who was being interviewed by this author, and she was writing a story on him, and she went in. She was an atheist. She expected to hate everything that he said, and what she found out is she really liked this guy. And when she gave her report and she wrote her article, she said something to the effect of, I need to say right up front and say it loudly, I actually liked him. It totally surprised her. And so therefore she thought it would surprise all her readers that anybody could actually like him. And what she said was, everything that he said went against the grain, my grain as an atheist. Everything that he said. But he cared about me. And he cared about my soul. I don't know an atheist who cares about my soul. Why would they? But this man cared about my soul. He tempted me to want to care about my own soul. That's what she wrote. Tempted me. Now, I don't know what God did with that truth in her life, but at that moment she shrunk back. That's not what we do. But we live in that way, where the world sees us and they say, you're going to tempt me to care about my own soul because you care about it because of this day. Father, we are grateful to you that you are a God who has everything planned from the beginning to the end. You have it all worked out. You are summing up all things in Jesus, and who can doubt your counsel? We are a people, Father, who look around us, and there are times that we look at the world, and we're so tempted to think that evil is going to have its way. And we know that things are not as bad as they could get, but we do know that on that last day, you will set everything right. We are tempted in our own life to give up. We are tempted to shrink back, but we're reminded in your scriptures that if we are Christ, Christ did not shrink back. He went to the cross and it was the joy that was set before him that motivated him to that. And so we come as a people trusting in you, trusting that we follow the one who is tempted but without sin, and we hold on to your promises that on that day you will take your people and you will gather them into the harvest of the righteous that receive your blessing for eternity. And make us people, Father, who remember, make us people who understand. And not only that we don't forget, but that we remember the truth and that we are compassionate in warning others. So we are thankful for your word. In Jesus' name, amen.